Planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the Golden Age.
Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Adam. We're the Vox Duo, and we're here to talk about what a great time this is to be entertained. Case in point, we now have a web series, which is a form of distribution unknown 20 years ago, and we have a successful Punisher adaptation on it. Which has also been unknown since as long as mankind has roamed the Earth. The Punisher is, of course, one of Marvel Comics' famous characters, a vigilante who kills people with, get this, very clever, guns, and has a large white stylized skull on his chest. He started off, at least, you know, I don't know that this connection has been drawn, which is another way of saying that the connection has probably been drawn over and over and over again, and I think I'm so smart for coming up with it, but in fact it is known. But I'm pretty sure he's based on the Executioner, the character Mac Bolan, who was in all these pulp novels. And that character, you know, is really old. His family got killed by the Mafia, so he waged war against the Mafia. In each novel, he's killing people in very clever ways with heavy ordnance, and he's an ex-military hero. Anyway, it hit at the right time, and since then, the Punisher has given us loads of unentertaining entertainment, including a Dolph Lundgren movie in 1989, the Thomas Jane film, of course, which was just at the turn of the century, and John Travolta was the bad guy. And then finally, a movie that even I thought was going to be good, and I couldn't even make it through the first third of, starring Ray Stevenson and directed by Lexi Alexander. That was awful, too. And yet, they persevered. And now we have a very popular Netflix show starring The Punisher and starring the new hotness, Jon Bernthal.
So that's the world that this Punisher TV show showed up in. But the question we all have to ask ourselves is the TV show actually any good? So Adam, I'm going to ask you one very simple question about the Punisher.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
I was, and I was feeling skeptical when I started the show, so it was a pleasant surprise. There's been a series of Netflix Marvel shows, of course, and Netflix shows in general, and they all seem to share certain faults, and I really figured that this one would be more of the same. But nevertheless, my wife and I decided to give it a try, and we found ourselves going through it fairly quickly.
And I should say that my reputation was on the line with this here, because I watched the entire show before Adam did, and was pleasantly surprised myself, and told Adam that this was actually a good show. And then I had to wait in suspense and make sure that it wasn't just me hallucinating it being a good show.
Is that why I watched it? Did you recommend it to me? That may have been the tipping factor. I am at the point now where I don't necessarily watch every superhero show just because it exists. So that may have done it.
We are so flooded with good entertainment that Adam has started drowning and has started rejecting the entertainment as it comes in. I did watch it, and I told you a couple of times that I thought it was really good. Although, given the way you've been working the past couple of weeks, I will absolutely forgive you for totally forgetting that.
So, Joe, what is it that you found so entertaining about The Punisher in the broadest of strokes? And then we'll just get into the nitty-gritty.
In the broadest of strokes, I really liked the character. I really liked the way the character was portrayed. And I really liked the supporting cast around the character. And it felt like every episode was actually doing something meaningful, rather than just spinning its wheels. And we can go into each of those elements more in depth. But at a really high level, it was just a good character with a good supporting cast of characters that didn't waste its time and didn't waste my time.
Were you familiar with the character before you watched the show?
I had seen the Thomas Jane movie. I actually went with some friends in college to see that, and we all regretted the experience when we walked out of the movie theater. That was pretty much my some exposure to Punisher. I had some vague knowledge that the Punisher was this guy who shot up his enemies, which is, in the world of comic books, definitely novel. Other than that, no, I'd had no exposure to him whatsoever.
Okay. One thing that I find interesting about the success of this particular iteration is that it kind of, I don't know, maybe it doesn't disprove it, but there's been theorizing for some time about why it is the Punisher has not caught on. They've made more of a try at him than most other characters because he's so easy to transfer to the screen. You know, the technology wasn't available for Spider-Man in the 1980s, but you could always do an action hero with guns. And I think the general wisdom was that there's nothing that actually separates the character from your general action star, that he is only special as an action, a gunswinging action star in the context of the Marvel Universe. There's not really another character like that, or at least there wasn't at the time. And once you strip him of that context, then he's just another man with a gun.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. He is looked at in that light, a fairly generic action hero. I think there's also the aspect that he's a little bit unsympathetic in the way he is. He's very driven by vengeance. He's lost his family, and sure, you can understand that, and you can understand his initial quest to avenge himself upon the people that killed his family. But then I think once you get to stories, and I'm going to be very interested to see if there's a season two of Punisher where this goes. Once his family's been avenged and you get to other stories, how do you make him a sympathetic character who's just ruthlessly mowing down anyone that he thinks hasn't been doing what they should be or has been doing stuff wrong? Because you can get into a vigilante hero who beats the crap out of people and then leaves them tied to a streetlight for the police to come pick up. Here's a guy, he's capturing the crooks and then he's letting the system take care of him. But the Punisher is a guy who's made himself judge, jury, and executioner. And I think that's inherently a less sympathetic character.
It's worth noting that the Punisher was originally introduced as a villain in The Amazing Spider-Man, I believe, and for quite some time before he got really popular, that was the character's role. That he came on just like the Green Goblin and the Scorpion, and was someone who had to be put down. They do try to make him sympathetic in this story, and I'm curious how good of a job you feel they did. In the comics, the best stories or the best series that have been produced starring the Punisher were by Garth Ennis, and he abandoned the idea, essentially, of trying to make the Punisher sympathetic. He treated the character more like the monster in a horror movie. You know, he is this force, and the other characters are fleshed out enough to where you're interested in whether they live or die.
Yeah, I read a couple of issues, literally two, of the Garth Ennis Punisher series that you recommended to me. And I can very definitely see how you're characterizing that as him as a force of nature rather than as a sympathetic character. I've very definitely gotten that impression reading those issues because the Frank Castle, as drawn by Garth Ennis, is not a sympathetic character. But I thought the Frank Castle that was in this Netflix Marvel series was a very sympathetic character. And that was one of the things that made me enjoy the show.
This is the same treatment that we got with Black Panther, too. In the Black Panther comics, he's less approachable, at least in the iconic version, but they did a pretty good job humanizing him in the movie. Well, let's jump into it. So Frank Castle, a.k.a. the Punisher, when last we left our hero, has successfully killed every member of every one of the five gangs involved in the firefight that led to his family's death. He becomes aimless until he's found by Micro, who is this comic book version of Edward Snowden, who's been in hiding since he blew the whistle on a drug-running scheme in Afghanistan. Frank Castle and his team in Afghanistan, because Frank Castle is a veteran, were unknowingly involved in the drug-running scheme, and so Frank Castle accepts Micro's offer to help him kill everyone involved in the conspiracy. And the first thing to note is that's just the setup. That's the first couple of episodes. And I think it's that's how they set things up was kind of impressive.
Yeah, it was. And we literally started with just the first 5 or 10 minutes of the first episode, resolved him killing everyone who had been in the gangs or gang leadership that had been involved in his family's death, tying up kind of loose ends from the end of Daredevil season 2, which left it with a little bit of a question right there at the very beginning of, okay, where's this going to go? Because he's killed everyone he's known about. So what's next? And what you do see next is a very heavily bearded version of Frank Castle swinging a sledgehammer at a construction site. Pretty much, he shows up to work. He eats his sandwich at lunch break. He swings a sledgehammer the other 8 or 9 hours of the day. He doesn't talk to anyone, and he goes home. And it really looks like Frank Castle he's done what he set out to do. He's avenged his family, and now he's just going to survive, I guess, for the next however many years. But it doesn't look like he's really living at this point, and that's where we start the show off.
Opening thoughts here. First of all, I really liked that clean break where Frank Castle finishes his war and then needs another one, because that plays into the great theme of the story. And that's what the writing team did great for me in The Punisher. That, you know, the first thing to do when you take these pulp characters who are essentially trudging through issue after issue of whatever adventure the writers can throw at them in comics is to take these characters and make them about something again. And in this case, I thought they hit on a great idea, which is that Frank Castle is a soldier and he needs a war. So they turn his war on crime into a metaphor for the needs of discharged veterans to have a war to fight.
Yeah, that's a very interesting theme that runs through the show, not just with Frank Castle, but with other characters. He needs a war to fight. He needs a purpose. He needs something to do to organize his life. And I think there are some things to talk about with how this show depicts the military and depicts veterans. I don't know that I'm 100% comfortable or happy with it, but it definitely does play into the show as a whole, having a thematic through line that binds everything together.
I do want to talk about how veterans are portrayed in this story, because I think our views on that might be interesting. But I am going to talk just a little bit about the plot here for a moment and say that there is one place I'm kind of dinging it for. You know, there is this clean break at the start of the story in which Frank Castle has finished his war and then he needs another. But they do try to tie his family's death back into this new conspiracy that he's informed of. And it's a sign of the failure of, or the tenuousness of that connection, that even after watching the whole show and refreshing myself, I'm still not 100% sure why this military conspiracy is to blame for the deaths of his family.
I think it ties in with the end of Daredevil, or with the entirety, really, of Daredevil Season 2. And we may want to backtrack and talk about the problems with Daredevil Season 2 as a microcosm of the problems of these Netflix Marvel shows in general, because I think it's a good exemplar of the problem, and I think it ties into the plot here. I actually liked the plot in The Punisher. I thought it was the story behind the story. The story that we'd gotten in Daredevil Season 2 honestly felt a little thin, and this is the story behind the story made it make more sense to me. But we can certainly talk about whether or not you think I'm right with that. I think I would like to go back to Daredevil season 2 and take a brief digression to talk about the problem with the Netflix Marvel shows in general, if you don't mind.
Okay, yeah, sure, go for it. DD2, of course, being where the Punisher was introduced, and this iteration being so beloved that he got his own show.
So, the problem I've had with the Netflix Marvel shows, and it's really just been one big problem, rather than a bunch of little problems, is that I feel the plots sag, and the seasons are too long for the amount of story that's actually there. And it feels like a lot of episodes, you're getting about a third to a half of an episode's worth of actual story. And then you're getting two-thirds to half of an episode's worth of walking around in circles, wasting time. I've always felt that the visuals for all of the series are excellent. The casting is superb. The music and sound design is interesting and ties in well to the theme of the show. But the story just feels like there isn't so much there. And I'm curious if you agree with that general impression.
Yeah, I do agree. I think if there has been any real weakness to the Netflix Marvel series, and maybe even some of the Netflix series in general, it's been that they've... No, okay, this is specifically a Marvel thing. They felt cheap. I feel like I notice it... Yes, the writing has been the main problem, as well as a little bit of a cheapness to the production values. Sometimes you notice that they're really not trying hard. Like when in the Punisher series that we're talking about today, you look at some of the private bodyguards. They are not very intimidating people, and you realize they just took whatever extras they could find and put them in dark clothes. That kind of thing seems to happen where if you look at the background, you realize that they're cutting corners where they can. But yes, just in general, I would agree that the writing tends to be where points get taken off for me when it comes to Marvel Netflix.
So Daredevil season 2, and the reason why I think this is a good example, Daredevil season 2 is all about Daredevil's run-in with the Punisher. There is Matt Murdock, who feels conflicted about his own role as a vigilante and is really pondering throughout the season whether or not he should hang up the Daredevil helmet and just do life as Matt Murdock, blind attorney. And he's pretty much leaning that direction of retiring Daredevil. And then Frank Castle starts going on his methodical walk through the city, taking out everyone who was involved in the shootout that killed his family. And I guess in case we've got any viewers who really love listening to us and haven't actually seen the series, we should briefly summarize what happened. Frank Castle had been a Marine serving in Afghanistan, had a family living in New York City. He'd come home from the war, was ready to resume life with his family. He and his family went to Central Park, were riding a carousel, and while they were at Central Park that day, a gun battle broke out between five rival gangs from around the city. And in the crossfire, Frank was injured and the entire rest of his family was killed. And ever since, he's been looking for vengeance on the gangs that opened fire in a public area, putting innocent people at risk and killing his own family. And he's really been driven just by that sense of revenge. And so in Daredevil season 2, we get the story of how he starts out seeking that revenge and running up against Matt Murdock, who doesn't like the idea of another vigilante in the city, and especially doesn't like the idea of a vigilante who is bloodily killing people rather than letting the legal system take care of them. So that's the setup for DD Season 2. And honestly, there's a little bit of confrontation between Daredevil and between the Punisher. Frank Castle eventually gets arrested and put on trial for his crimes. And so there's the legal defense of Matt Murdock and Foggy Nelson defending Frank Castle in court. And it just didn't feel like there was that much story there. Frank commits some murders. They have some courtroom scenes. And it felt like it should have been 6, maybe 7 episodes worth of content to tell that story. And instead, what we got was a full 13 episodes padded out with this whole second story about Electronachios and the hand and stick and all of the more, call it supernatural aspects of their Daredevil story, which I'm really not that familiar with aside from what showed up in the TV series. But there was this whole second storyline that really felt like it was bolted onto the side of the Frank Castle storyline, and really to me felt like it was just there to take up space and make sure that we had enough content for 13 episodes.
Okay. You've said a lot here, and listeners, this actually will all tie back into our analysis of The Punisher, so bear with us. I know that we're on a whole different series now, but this speaks to how Netflix and Marvel in particular structures their plots. I disagree that the Elektra stuff was filler, but there was no payoff, so I'm not surprised that you think that way. What the Punisher does in that story is he starts off the show, I mean, right at the beginning, by introducing a question. He upsets the status quo with this question of life or death. You know, do you kill these people, or do you accept the destruction they're going to cause when you let them live? Daredevil says, go to hell, puts his butt down. Then Elektra is introduced, and she is on the Punisher's side, even though she loves Matt and she's considering changing for him. And they have this struggle where Elektra's an assassin and she just wants to kill people. And in fact, at one point, I think Daredevil even does kill someone while they're fighting. And then he's feels terrible about it. But they're lovers, and they're going to get away from it all. And then that's the whole second act, when they're in this conflict. And then what happens in the third act, Punisher gets free, and then Elektra dies. Now, I will go to my grave arguing that what was supposed to happen was the Punisher was supposed to kill Elektra, because Punisher gives Daredevil the chance to kill him. In, I think it's the third episode, he gives him a gun, and he gives him the option of shooting him and stopping him from killing someone else. And so the great punch of that story is that Daredevil's choice actually matters in that early episode. He could have saved Elektra's life by killing the Punisher there and then, thereby proving the Punisher's point. So those plots were supposed to work together. That said, you have totally hit upon the structure that all the other Netflix series seem to be using too. You look in Jessica Jones season 1, you look in The Punisher now, there's always the first act in which the main plot is introduced and then sort of put on the back burner while the secondary villain comes in during the second act and kind of from left field and kind of ups the stakes. And then after that, you return to the main plot. And I saw it coming from a mile away in The Punisher, and I saw it coming a mile away in Luke Cage and so forth. And they really do just seem to have got themselves into this form here that they keep using, but that keeps not quite working. A dissertation finished.
Yeah, and maybe that's what I don't like about it, is it feels like you're rolling along on plot one. You've got momentum. You can kind of see an outline of where the story is going, maybe not the exact details, but you can see the kind of structure of the story. And then it feels like you just get somebody pulls the emergency brake on a train and you come to a screeching halt and something else starts happening instead. And you completely lose the momentum on the first story that you were invested in. And worse, they start interspersing the two plots. So you get about 10 minutes of the story you were super invested in, maybe 15. And then you get a bunch of the B plot stuff. And it just feels like you're investing all this time in the series, but you're really only getting a little bit at a time of the main plot that you had gotten super invested in. And it never feels like their secondary plots are all that interesting.
Right. To be fair, the more I think about it, the more I feel like you can make the case that the secondary villain in The Punisher is not completely out of left field, in that he plays into the themes of the show, and he also illustrates perhaps what happens when a soldier doesn't have a war. Perhaps he's sort of a Punisher gone bad. What if Frank Castle never did find other people to kill? What happens then? And that's actually, this isn't really a spoiler. It's like saying the theme of Moby Dick is obsession, but Garth Ennis's great theme over his large run was this idea that ultimately Frank Castle's family was an excuse, not a reason.
Are we talking about Billy Russo here as the secondary villain in Punisher?
Oh, no, I consider him the main villain. Sorry, I'm talking about the blonde kid, whose name I can't even recall.
Oh, the Marine with PTSD.
Yes, him exactly.
Yeah, I felt that was a... You're right, that's a B-plot, but I felt that that was a B-plot that was fairly well integrated into the overall storyline. For whatever reason, it didn't feel as much like a bolt-on to me. I suppose I can see the argument that it was a bolt-on, it just didn't feel that way.
Okay, so that brings us back to the point that we've been trying to make all this time, which is that The Punisher doesn't feel like it suffers as much from this common Netflix problem of having too little story for too many episodes. And what do you think it is that makes it feel that way?
So, finishing up with Daredevil Season 2, the whole story of Daredevil Season 2 was Frank Castle finding all of the gangs that had been involved in his family's death and gunning them down. And there was a little bit of a question left of, okay, why were these gangs having a shootout in Central Park? What had brought them all there? Because it's not necessarily a normal thing for five gangs to have a five-sided shootout in public. And so that's left a little bit as a hanging question, and Punisher goes ahead and answers that question and says, okay, there was a story behind the story. Frank's family, spoilers, Frank's family was actually set up, and the hit was supposed to take out Frank himself as well. And the gangs were unwittingly doing someone else's bidding in order to make all of this happen, which is perhaps an elaborate and convoluted plot, but this is a comic book story. If it's not an elaborate and convoluted plot, what's the point?
touche. Again, I'm going to complain a little about it, although to be fair, this is not the Punisher writer's fault entirely. When you think about it, they were given the first season of a show, but the big story of their main character had already been done in another show's second season. So I can see them wanting to redo the story of how Frank's family died. But I don't think it was necessary. I thought that it was enough of a hook that Frank had been used, and that he is outraged due to his respect for the work that his fellow veterans had done, and the reasons why they had done it over in Afghanistan. And, you know, that deep sense of betrayal was enough to put him on a new course.
Yeah, I can see that. I do think having this tied to his family illustrates or provides a really, really good reason for what causes him to completely turn against Billy Russo. Because he and Russo had been the closest of buddies, and we see this in multiple flashbacks throughout the season. He and Russo had been the closest of friends. Russo having grown up as an orphan, not really having had a family, and Frank being the Marine with a family, he and Russo were almost brothers and had been super close. And by the end of the show, he wants to hurt Russo in the worst possible way that he can. And having this tied into Frank's family provides the perfect incentive for that in a way that perhaps another motivation might not have.
Okay, well, here we are, listeners. I think Joe and I are disagreeing a little bit. Maybe it's just how often it gets used, but I feel like I killed your family, or I helped kill your family, or your girlfriend, or your dad, or whatever, is so... I mean, yes, it's the ultimate insult, but consequently it's used enough to where it just has no effect on me personally. And so character-wise, I would have been more interested if Frank simply hated him for having taken this one thing that he holds on to as noble, which is this brotherhood that he had established with these other soldiers, and had profaned it by using it to become rich.
Well, and it's not just that it's a betrayal of the brotherhood, or that it's, I killed your family, look at how evil I am. It's that Russo had practically been a member of Frank's family. Frank's kids called him Uncle Billy, and Frank's wife was close to him. Frank's kids were close to him. So it was more, I'm so amoral enough, I'm so duplicitous, that not only did I kill your family, but I killed people that were like family to me, or at least people who considered me to be family. I turned around and killed them in the pursuit of my own goals.
Yeah, all right. It's whatever floats your boat. Different strokes for different folks.
But going to this main theme that was through the story, the whole through line to the story, and we'll go ahead and thoroughly spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it, is that Frank's unit in Afghanistan was being used to smuggle drugs, heroin, out of Afghanistan back into New York City, where Frank's superior officers were selling it and pocketing immense amounts of cash. And unbeknownst to Frank, his squad mate Billy Russo was involved in this entire scheme. And Frank had stumbled onto some stuff in Afghanistan that, had he put all of the pieces together, would have blown this entire heroin smuggling operation sky high. And so Frank's family, and the attempt was made to kill Frank himself, the whole hit was arranged to take out Frank before he could discover that his superior officers were involved in this and blow the whistle on them.
Right. And so, irregardless of what else you've got, there's the whole central plot. You've got the story about veterans and what they do when they return from war, and the tight bonds that they form during war. And Frank believes in this, and especially after he becomes the Punisher, it's the only thing that he holds sacred. And then he finds that he was working for people who didn't respect that, regardless of the terrible things he did. So he gets to... there are two other characters who are involved in this. There's Micro, the Edward Snowden-like character, a whistleblower who tried to blow the whistle on this particular conspiracy and has been hiding out ever since. And then you've got the FBI agent Madani, who lost a partner trying to uncover the same conspiracy. And if you want to look at it structurally, you have these two different sides, both trying to solve the same crime. One according to the law, by using Frank Castle as a witness, and one just by extra legally, by using Frank Castle as a weapon.
Exactly. And I think what made the overall writing of this story work for me was the fact that it was a mystery. It was an investigation. It was an investigation being run along parallel lines. And the entire thing was made complex enough that there was enough content for 13 episodes to really dig into all the details of this conspiracy. Because it wasn't just Frank and Madani digging for facts. It was that the people on the other end of the conspiracy were still actively working to cover up everything that they had done. So there was a little bit of cat and mouse back and forth with, can we destroy certain bits of evidence or get rid of certain witnesses before Frank and Madani uncover what's connecting everything together? And so it was this constant movement through all 13 episodes of that main plot. It was constantly moving, of them uncovering evidence, of them moving forward step by step, but having to deal with the roadblocks that were being thrown in their way by the other characters. That, to me, it really felt like there was 13 episodes worth of full story there, that it couldn't really have been done any quicker without cutting out necessary bits of the process. And so this was a story that felt like it needed 13 episodes to tell the whole thing.
Exactly so. I really appreciated it. And, you know, it's not that difficult to do is the thing. All you need to do is create a mystery that involves 13 steps. a story doesn't have to even be 3X. You can have 5 if that's how many, if that's how much space you need. You can see the deliberateness of what they're doing, I think, in how each episode parcels out the mystery. There's a very clear point at which things change at the end of every episode, usually. You know, if in the first episode, Frank Castle essentially gets goaded into killing some people, and then, bang, that puts him on Micro's radar. Episode 2, Micro introduces himself, and then, bang, Punisher finds him. Episode 3, you know, and so on and so forth. Each time, there's a very clear plot point, as opposed to 3 episodes of this more nebulous character development or what have you. So it's not rocket scientist, but they did it right and they made it work.
Yeah, they did. And it's the fact that everything takes the time that it needs to take. You know, Frank is not a superhero with incredible healing abilities like Captain America. He gets injured in these fights and has to be out of commission for what should honestly probably be months, but is actually days, recovering from his latest sets of wounds. But it makes sense.
He doesn't quite follow human biology in that story.
But it takes him days instead of the minutes it takes Captain America. So it fits in the accelerated timelines of comic book healing. But no, it makes sense that the story has to stop and do something else while he's healing. It's not just walking in circles for the sake of walking in circles. And while he's healing, you get Micro advancing the plot by doing something hacking or spying related to uncover more facts. Or you get Madani advancing the plot by using the resources at her disposal to figure stuff out. So where it's not just we spend time with somebody at Frank's bedside and flashbacks, although there are plenty of flashbacks, but we get other characters advancing the plot while Frank is out of commission. And I really enjoyed that.
How much did the flashbacks add to your viewing experience, by the way? Obviously, he's plagued by these nightmares regarding his family and the conspiracy and everything else. They were used time and time again as the teaser, essentially, for each episode. I started feeling myself become inured to them as the episode count went on.
I think I would say they didn't affect me as much at the end as they did at the beginning, but at the same time, it felt natural to Frank's character that you were seeing these repeated scenes because you're getting inside Frank's head, and this is Frank's life. Frank is haunted by recurring memories of his family and of the good times that were interrupted. And so it doesn't feel as time-wasty as another show might, because this is who Frank is.
All right. So that's the plot. It moves along at a better clip. Maybe not my preferred pace, which is the CW, where everything gets resolved within 2 episodes, but it moves pretty fast.
Yeah, the CW moves too fast. You know, that's a whole different conversation about what's wrong with those shows. But we'll stick to Marvel for tonight.
You mentioned character, and I do have to say that I enjoyed the interplay between Frank and Micro, as well as Frank and Micro's wife and the family. The relationships mostly worked for me. And it's impressive that in this story about this remorseless killer they did a good job of humanizing these characters.
Well, that you beat me to the point. The relationship between Frank and Micro's family, especially, I really loved, because it showed that Frank Castle isn't just a cold-blooded killer. He misses his family, and there were a lot of ways a lot of different moments in the episodes where I got the opinion that he was using his relationship with Micro's family to plug a little teeny tiny bit of the hole in his own life where he was missing his own family. You know, Micro had two kids, a girl and a boy, same as Frank did, and had a good relationship with his wife before his entire family thought he was dead. And by interacting with them, I think that did a little bit to heal Frank emotionally, to show that he could still experience human feelings rather than just being a killing machine.
Yeah, it goes a long way that they don't play Frank as this emotionally dead cartoon. He is still recognizably a human being, and that being the case, we can like him. I thought they did a good job of developing the family in such a way that you were interested in what was going on with them, particularly with the wife, because of course we all saw her developing this idea in her head of the good-looking ex-Marine at her door, probably early on, and that was sort of this very slow wreck, potential wreck coming that you were interested in watching.
And that, to me, is another thing. All of the characters in the show, maybe not all, almost all of the characters in the show, felt like really developed personalities in their own right. The show wasn't just about Frank, although it focused on him. Micro had his own very well-developed personality, motivations, and drives. And Micro's wife had her own well-fleshed-out character, and the kids had their own characters as well. And it was watching the interplay between everybody with everybody else was one of the things that really made the show pop for me. And if you haven't seen the show, you know, Micro is an NSA analyst who is fantastic at spying, and he's got somewhat understandably and somewhat creepily, I think you can go both ways on this. You can totally understand where he's coming from while also still acknowledging it's a little bit creepy. He's got his house completely wired for sound and video from multiple angles in every room. So he is keeping very, very close watch over his family while he's gone and they think he's dead. And you can see the emotions on his face as Frank is interacting with his wife, and he's not sure if he trusts Frank at all to begin with, and he's really not sure that he trusts Frank with his family. And watching the agonized expressions that he has while Frank is interacting with his wife, and his wife is clearly considering putting the moves on Frank, and Micro is being conflicted about all of this. That, to me, was an ongoing thing throughout the show that just made the whole thing pop and feel more real and more human.
Yeah, it's just good drama. You don't blame any of the characters involved, but there's clearly a problem that's developed. Loved it.
Let's see. Other points I wanted to make about the series. Yeah, just the Micro Castle interaction and relationship, something that started off immensely distrustful on both sides at the very beginning and had turned into an actual partnership by the end, and watching that develop and both of these characters being a little bit cold in how they interacted with everybody else, a little bit cold with how they interacted with each other, both of them having very definite ends and goals in mind, and clashing with each other frequently over methods and means. That was another thing that really made the whole show pop for me. It felt like there was a really good relationship driving the central plot. And then as well, the relationship between Madani and Russo drove quite a lot of the plot. And again, just watching characters interact with each other, especially when you knew things that the characters didn't, and you could watch the tension play out in scenes, it was just immensely entertaining.
Yeah, you know, you talk about it, and I'm becoming more appreciative over here. All of the characters, you're right, the plot was character-driven, and not only that, but all of the characters' motivations were clear. And I'd say simple, but not in a bad way.
and you understood why they couldn't or what the obstacles were within those goals. Really, it's just, it is an example of a story that is not trying to be high art, but is just trying to do the fundamentals well. And so often I can appreciate that more. just a solid exercise and an action story is a good thing. I mean, if you described it to me, I might have been bored if you were summarizing it. The government conspiracy. There's not an original element in here. From how the drugs are run out of Afghanistan to who's behind it all, and yet I wasn't bored because it was all about something interesting, and it was well paced and plotted, and I understood what was going on the whole time.
I would call this almost clockwork pacing in the best possible sense of the term. Every character has their own motivations, goals, things they're willing to do and things they're not willing to do. And you start them out at different points on the board. You wind them all up and you let them go. And they all go in somewhat predictable directions, but those directions are all key to who they are and what their character is. And the interaction between everyone acting according to who they are is what made the show really go, especially when you had characters working at cross purposes, and it didn't feel like manufactured drama. It felt completely legitimate.
There you go. In fact, I think this ties a little bit into our earlier conversation about the Black Panther. I think this is a good example of taking the stock elements and turning them into a compelling story that never really surprises you. Because there are no surprises in this story. I think we all pegged Billy Russo as a bad guy pretty early on, and nobody else's matters. And there are no other major reveals, really, are there?
No, I don't think there are. Once you know for sure that Billy isn't just overly smarmy, that he really is evil, everything else proceeds according to the way you think it would proceed. And really, if I was going to have any complaint about the show, it's that Agent Orange is the one cardboard character in the whole enterprise. There's really nothing interesting about him whatsoever. Billy's interesting because he was close to Castle's family and was really close to Castle, and yet is a completely amoral scumbag. So his character was interesting, but Agent Orange was totally boring. But you're right. Once you know who Billy is, there's really no surprises. It's just waiting until the characters put all the pieces together themselves and learn what the audience already knows.
There was one scene that I was on tenterhooks regarding, because they had set up a really good question of what was going to happen next. And that was when Madani, the FBI agent who's trying to unveil the whole conspiracy, successfully tricks the conspiracy, Billy Russo and his soldiers, into trying to kill the Punisher. And really, she's there and ready to ambush them. And as Billy Russo's team was entering that warehouse and falling into Agent Madani's trap, I really didn't know how that was going to go.
And it's interesting when you mentioned that being a real point of tension and a surprise. As soon as you said there was one point, that was the scene that my mind instantly went to, where no idea. Is she going to uncover him and the show's going to go in one direction where he goes into hiding and she's tracking him down? Or is he going to successfully escape and she'll continue interacting with him, not knowing who he is and what he is and how close he was to killing her and her team? And of course, she doesn't unmask him. And then you get what to me was a fairly chilling scene at the end, where she is completely in shock, covered in blood, trying to process this entire attack that went down and how many members of her team died. And Billy is right there comforting her. as she struggles to process everything. And more than anything else in the show, that scene with Billy there right after he'd killed her partner and so many members of her team did more to reveal his psychopathic nature than anything else in the show did.
And that was a great ending. Maybe the best episode of the lots, come to think of it. It's hard to judge them retroactively like that, but it was definitely one of the high points for me as well.
I think we've about exhausted what we like about the show in large part. And I know we'd wanted to talk about one of the themes, how it portrays the military and how it portrays people who come home from the war. So this seems like maybe the appropriate time to switch to that.
Okay. So obviously the theme is veterans and also how they are supported after they come home or not supported. The basic problem of being a veteran is that you go to war, or at least if you're, a traumatized veteran, is that you go into this war zone and you experience things which leave you unfit, perhaps, for anything other than that war zone, or perhaps not even fit for that. And then you come home and you're dumped, and you don't have that working environment that you've become good at. So what do you do? And if you're not, and are you capable of being retrained? The supporting character spends a lot of his time trying to convince these ex-soldiers that they're not still soldiers and that they can be something else. And this is not something he necessarily believes on every given day. In Frank's case, of course, he... As the ending makes abundantly clear, he's a soldier without a war as well. He needs a war to keep going.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed the scenes with Curtis and with Curtis leading the veterans support group that he was doing, the scenes of Curtis interacting with Frank, and the scenes of Curtis interacting with Lewis Wilson, who is the soldier who can't make a life for himself outside of the war zone. I really enjoyed those sequences. And as far as B stories go, this one felt maybe more integral than most. And maybe it's because it's so closely tied into the overall theme of how Frank himself dealt with being home from the war, that it didn't feel like a distraction from the main story. But it also felt like the type of thing that as Frank's going through and he's interacting with Curtis, this is what Curtis is dealing with, and Frank kind of keeps bumping up against it, as indeed Frank ends up dealing with Lewis himself. So that all felt pretty organic to me. I think, if anything, my problem with this portrayal is the rest of the members of the group that Curtis has, aside from Lewis, the rest of the members of the group aren't really filled out, so we don't really know how they're doing. Curtis is doing fine. He's adjusted to life outside of a war zone. But Frank, as we've already said, Frank needs a war to fight. Russo's just interested in his own greed, both in and out of the war zone, so I guess he's fine. The war didn't screw him up. He was screwed up when he went into the war. And then our other main veteran character is Lewis, who is completely screwed up by the war. And so I got the impression that the show was depicting that mostly you go to a war zone and you come home completely screwed up. And I don't know. I'm not sure that I like that.
Well, obviously it's true for a set of veterans. Maybe a better way of characterizing the theme for this show would be veterans' issues as opposed to veterans.
Yeah, I think that's true, and that's why I'm very conflicted, because obviously there are people who struggle with exactly these things and who struggle to readjust and to fit in, and the show was already complicated enough. There's not really room in it to have characters who are doing just fine, so Curtis is their stand-in. So I'm not really disappointed or upset with this part of the show, but it was one of those minor nits that rubbed me a little bit the wrong way, is that it seemed like it was portraying more veterans than not as having issues, and I think in the real world the reverse is true.
I think Curtis has issues too, for the record. He's fighting with a sense of helplessness and uselessness, in part because he lost his leg.
Yeah, that's true.
There's also this interesting reversal of the issue in the character that mentors Lewis for a while, who pretends to be a soldier. So this little bit of commentary on how being a soldier is held in such high esteem, and these people are having such problems.
Yeah, that part I really did like, that whole issue of stolen valor, that here's a guy who's talking about his exploits in Vietnam, and it turns out he's never even been to Vietnam, and how that rubs real soldiers the wrong way. I really liked that minor sub-subplot of the show and the story. To me, that felt like a... And I can't really talk about it because I've never been in the military and you've never been in the military. But it felt like a thing that felt real.
I go back and forth myself and my comfort with how the soldiers are presented in the film, but it's more of a question for me of whether they're being romanticized. I'm not a militarist, and I really dislike how the United States of America worships the idea of the soldier and war and glorifies these things. But what I keep coming back to is that the film is about, the lie of that, you know, while we supposedly worship these things, in fact, we leave them broken. And what's more, that the emotional connections that these men have with each other as a result of their experience are real. And so that I have no problem with. You know, I can watch, I'd have trouble watching a movie that was about Republicans being great, but I could watch a movie about Republicans who think what they're doing is great.
In a last conversation we had, you introduced me to a really fancy word that is when a plot is kind of doing the opposite of what the main point of the plot is, and I remember the concept clearly and have forgotten the word entirely. But I think it applies. I think it very definitely applies here, because one of the things we mentioned last time around is movies that try to say war is hell, but actually end up making war look romanticized, even in its hellishness. And Punisher, I thought, neatly avoided that trap. The message is war is hell and screws you up. And we see a bunch of people who are really screwed up by the war in a way that you wouldn't say, hey, I should enlist and go join the military.
Okay, now we're getting to something else I really wanted to discuss, though. And we need to be careful about how we talk about this, just because I don't think we want to get into a basic issues discussion. But I felt torn a bit as I watched this series, perhaps particularly in light of the recent shootings, the opening sequences that, you know, lovingly and show gun after gun, and, you know, just started to tug at my soul a little bit. And what's more, I don't know, it's been a while since I was a teenager, and now when I see the Punisher ripping through all these bad guys and executing them, I mean, we always understood that this was not okay in civilized society, but there's also this implicit understanding of, but it's okay.
I mean, these guys are really, really bad. So executing them, it's wrong, but it's not really wrong, if you know what I mean.
Right. Now, you know, I mean, I actively, professionally even advocate for civil rights, and I couldn't help but thinking during some of these episodes as he executed a bunch of mafia people, I don't actually want this to happen.
You know, Frank Castle, not big on due process.
Exactly. And, you know, there's always this sort of hand-waving regarding you know, but is what he's doing... No, no, okay. It wasn't hand-waving at this point. It was treated as an actual question. And, you know, but is he doing what's right? Karen Page kind of agonizes about this, you know. Aren't you just killing people? Well, yes, he's just killing people, is my personal response to this. I'm not, it's not, you know, this deep philosophical quandary to me. And it worries me that it's treated that way. Is it just being dumb? Is this dumb television that I'd like to be smarter? Or is this insidious? Or both?
It's a good question. I do think it's... No, I was going to say... I think it's obvious that what he's doing is wrong, but in the context of the show, in the context of Russo and what Frank knows and what Frank uncovers, it's not clear that what he's doing is wrong, because there is a very real chance that Agent Orange gets away with everything he does. Agent Orange comes within a step and a half of not only getting away with everything he's done, but being given medals for it, being praised for it, and being promoted because of it. And so in that context, you see Frank doing what only Frank can do, and throwing due process to the side and running through and killing everyone. And it does begin to look as well, and sometimes the law breaks down, and in order for justice to triumph, a brutal, violent man has to do what society can't do. And you're right, it's insidious. I don't think I agree with that. I think I am more on Karen Page's side and on Madani's side of saying we need to gather the evidence, and then we need to take care of this the right way.
Yeah, which... happens toward the end. They still have their great evil, they still have their great final battle where Frank simply kills them. But at the same time, Madani does win by having Frank sit down and get interviewed. So, you know, you kind of have this dual prosecution, which I'm sure is intentional.
Yeah, and by the end, Agent Orange's superiors actually know what he's been up to and are suitably disgusted and completely turn against him. So there is this view that, hey, if you give the right people the right evidence, they will do the right thing. So it's not as clear-cut as everything has to be done Frank's way. But at the same time, yeah, I do think on balance it paints violent vigilantism in a little bit too good of a light.
It does take a dim view of... You know, I was talking earlier about my concerns that this show was perhaps a little too militaristic, but to be fair, it does take a very cynical view of what it is that what governments make soldiers do. You know, the Afghanistan war, the torture that goes on, and so forth. There's plenty of that. So I don't know. And
yeah, dare I say it? This is possibly even a show with a little bit of a libertarian message. You can't trust your government. You can't trust your superiors, those who you think you can follow to do the right thing and to establish moral guideposts for you, turn out to have been smuggling heroin all along. So really, everybody's out for their own good. And what more of a libertarian message could you possibly want?
I was reading. I have a few go-to critics, and I was curious what Alan Sepinwall had to say about the show, because he was particularly negative about it. And he described Frank's vendetta as being based on the premise that, or he described Frank as killing the people in the government because they had him kill people. under false pretenses, you know, this idea that, okay, at least I did it. I thought I was doing it for my country. And turns out that wasn't even true, which I guess makes sense. That's the whole idea of justifiable war. He thought that he was doing what had to be done. And when that turned out not to be the case, then he flipped.
Yeah, you see in multiple flashbacks that he's uncomfortable with what Operation Cerberus, which is the operation he's involved with in Afghanistan. You see that he's uncomfortable with it. Well, I read episode summaries before we started. I cheated. He's uncomfortable with it, but he's going along with it because his superiors are telling him it's necessary for justice to triumph. And you're right. He kind of flips when he finds out that there is no justice in this whatsoever. It's all for private gain. And, you know, I was being tongue-in-cheek when I said this could be a show with a libertarian message, because as libertarians, we don't approve of indiscriminate violence in taking the law into your own hand. There does have to be due process. There does have to be evidence gathered. You can't just deprive someone of life, let alone liberty, without being darn sure. And Frank is very, very, very willing to eliminate someone based on a seems more likely than not standard of evidence, which is disturbing in a lot of ways.
I thought it was a very nice note toward the end where Madani learns that Frank was actually the masked soldier who shot her contact.
Yeah, you see that Madani is very ambivalent about Frank Castle through the entire thing. She acknowledges that he has good reason for his anger, but she heartily disapproves of his methods. And that made me like Madani as a character so much more, because she was very true to her own sense of justice, and the fact that she kind of personally liked Frank Castle didn't cause her to waver from that in any way.
Yeah, I thought maybe they overstepped a little bit in having her pack him off with a nice set of clothes. I thought that was maybe a little bit more than she owed him, but I agree that in general I liked it.
Well, and that fit in with a general sense of, I don't know how much she was in favor of packing him off at the end of the show, but her superiors were definitely willing to do it in an effort to sweep everything under the rug and not have any chance of it coming to light publicly.
Right. Speaking of endings, I said this to you by text after I finished the show, but I really thought Micro's family was going to die.
There were multiple times I thought his family was going to bite the big one and become casualties in the war, and the fact that they didn't is almost a little bit of a surprise in the show, because in a show so dedicated to personal pain, what would have been more fitting than for a second family to get wiped out in front of Frank's eyes?
And what's more, it sets up the setup is what I was about to say. But I mean, which, you know, it's terrible. But you know, I think in the comics, it's actually the case that Micro, or Microchip as he's called, joins the Punisher's quest because he has a similar backstory. His family or his wife died. So, you know, at the end of season one, if Micro's family dies, then you've got two men who've lost their loved ones on the road together, righting wrongs, and you're all set. But
oh, then it becomes a buddy road show.
Which, you know, exactly, which in a sense is not so different from what we had this season, which is one of the things that continually surprises me anyway about this Marvel Netflix series in general. And one thing that I like about them a lot, that they're willing to give solid endings to the seasons. I feel like more than even your standard TV show, you know, things wrap up. If there was never a second season of The Punisher, you would have felt like you got a full meal off this.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I like it because stories should be self-contained, and you should be able to tell a second story that's distinct from the first one without some kind of weak, lame attempt to make them segue from one to the other. Because we got this guy. We got Frank Castle. He's got stuff that happens to him, and it can be discrete stories without trying to make it all one big interconnected narrative that weakly flows from one season to another.
Yeah, I feel like they didn't even try to tease us, you know, to give us this question that's going to make us come back for season two. I mean, yes, Billy Russo ends the show in the hospital with his face bandaged, but, you know, yeah, maybe he comes back, or maybe he's doomed to be a vegetable his whole life. It's not pressing.
Or maybe we just haven't met him yet in Jessica Jones Season 2.
You haven't seen any of those episodes, so I'm sure that's not a spoiler.
No, I haven't seen any of those episodes. It just seems like the kind of thing Marvel might do.
One of the reasons we love him. Okay, what do you have any other notes, Joe?
I didn't have any notes to begin this whole thing, Adam. No, I think I've said everything that I really wanted to say about The Punisher. I mean, we've spent the last hour or so analyzing it, but I'm just going to go back to I loved the theme song. I loved how the guitar playing of the theme song tied into Castle playing guitar in the flashbacks with his family. I love the sound design, the visual design. Once again, as is we've said many times with Marvel, love the casting. Marvel does a fantastic job with casting. Love the interaction with the characters. This is the first Marvel TV show out of not just the Netflix ones, but the ones on any channel that I would say I've loved almost without reservation. This was just a great show.
Did you like Madani's sidekick?
Her erstwhile partner that got knocked off?
Right. I never could quite tell what was wrong with that guy. I didn't know if it was his acting chops or what, but he always struck me as dissonant from the rest of the cast.
He felt a little like Foggy Nelson 2.0 in a minor way. Yeah, he didn't quite seem to fit in with everything else.
It was his delivery more than anything. It was how he talked. I don't know. It was just always odd to me.
Yeah, I wouldn't say he impinged upon me much one way or the other. He was just kind of there, and then he wasn't, and that moved the plot along. Phylum with Agent Orange is a character that seemed a little cardboardy.
Oh, yeah, but he was just blank. He belongs in a Marvel movie. All right, well, let's hope the next Netflix show goes as well as this one, because I feel like they're improving at this rate.
Well, let's say this. Let's break it down this way to end. If we were going to give advice to the writers of Jessica Jones Season 2, which it's massively too late to do, but if we were going to distill the lessons from The Punisher and say, what should future Marvel writers do to make a compelling series of their show, what's the advice that we would give them?
Well, first of all, good news on that. I know I reported to you by text at one point that Jessica Jones 2 wasn't very good to start with, but I read a few headlines at least that suggested that that were titled Jessica Jones Season 2 stumbles out of the gate but then gains momentum and so forth. And a few friends on Facebook were saying, oh my God, I just finished, I'm in tears and whatnot. So maybe it's actually great. That said, especially for Jessica Jones, which is about a PI, my writing advice would be to figure out what your story is and then to parcel it out in very deliberate segments so that we always know what we've learned and that there's another compelling question to come rather than feel like we're ping-ponging back and forth looking for something to do. And Jessica Jones, I do recall losing a little bit of momentum. There was maybe one skirmish with the Purple Man too many in there. It was a great show, so we forgave it, but I don't think it had that pacing problem licked.
Yeah, well, Jessica Jones fits in. You know, I describe the problem that all the Marvel TV series has is sagging in the middle. They're good at the beginning, and they generally finish off really good. The last two or three episodes are always really strong. But it's that middle segment where everything just kind of sags and drags and loses momentum. And yeah, Jessica Jones Season 1 had exactly that problem. We got out really strong, and it felt like we were going to be heading up to some strong showdowns. And then we kind of wandered in circles a little bit for a couple of episodes until we got to the end. You bringing up that Jessica Jones is a PI brings up a good point. Part of the reason Punisher worked so well was because there was an actual mystery for Frank and Madani to solve, and Micro. Jessica Jones should have a good mystery for her to solve, something that requires actual investigation that parcels itself out into 13 steps, not where you have the crime three-quarters solved by episode 4 and then wander in circles doing other stuff before you finally get around to solving it.
Right, and I thought of this earlier. I'll mention it now. I thought the Punisher's mystery was much more intriguing than what the first season of Daredevil did, which I had problems with. Because in the first season of Daredevil, there's this very clear structure. There are 5 crime bosses, and Daredevil has to beat them all, almost like levels in a video game. But you see who the crime bosses are early on, and after that, since you already know who they are, it's essentially a case of just checking them off the list. You don't know what's... You already know, essentially, what's going to happen next, and I liked not knowing who was out there more.
And the other thing I think Marvel needs to do with this with these TV shows is... And maybe it's Netflix is ordering 13 episodes at a time, but I think there needs to be a willingness on the side of both Marvel and Netflix to go for shorter series. I really enjoyed The Defenders, and I'm not going to get into all of the reasons why, but I thought The Defenders was a really entertaining show, and it was all of 8 episodes. And there was enough story for 8 episodes, there was not enough story for more than 8 episodes, and they got in, they told the story they needed to tell, and they got out. And I think they need to be willing to do that, that if you've only got enough story for a certain number of episodes, don't pad it. Write a really, really good show with a smaller number of episodes.
Alternatively, why not just do multiple stories in a season, like so many television shows do, especially in regards to comics? I mean, comics, especially superhero comics, generally do this thing where they have an A plot, and then they have subplots B and C, and maybe D in the background. And then by the time A plot is over, B plot has kind of boiled into the full swing. And then you're dealing with the B plot while C and D are developing, and there's a new E plot. You know, there's this rotation that's always keeping you involved. And if you're really good, then all of this kind of climaxes or comes together by the end of the year of issues, or 2 years or what have you, you know, and then everything gets serious in the home stretch. That's a possibility. I feel that, yeah, things are so hidebound. I don't know why.
Yeah, I feel like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on ABC has been doing this. Season 4 was really 2 stories, or maybe even 3 stories in one season, and you got some rather tight arcs that did what they needed to do, wrapped up and moved on to a different arc, and they all played well with each other. And it was like you say, there was stuff developing in the background that when it was time bubbled up to became the main thing, but it moved snappily along. And Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is a show I've been thinking of telling you. I know you watched the first season or two and then bailed on it because it wasn't any good, which at the time was the right decision to do. I think, and I'm a little bit nervous to say this.
Decision.
I'm a little bit nervous to say this, but I think Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has gotten good again. I think it's found its stride, and it's a little bit limited by being on ABC and needing to comply story-wise with the rules for broadcast television. But that limitation aside, I feel like structurally it's gotten good. The actors and the characters have found their rhythm, and it's doing interesting stories that actually have clever, entertaining moments.
I wouldn't mind giving it a shot. I really wouldn't. Maybe we should make that one of our experiments.
Yeah, and we've got so much other stuff. It's not high up on the list, but given that it's gotten a bad rep among fandom for being not great, I just wanted to give it a shout out and say, hey, the people who are involved with it have stuck with it, and I think they're finally figuring out how to do it right, and they're doing it right in a way maybe the other Marvel shows could learn from.
Considering that this is so many other Netflix shows share the structural weaknesses of Marvel's Netflix shows, I have to imagine that this is a remit from Netflix itself. Much like there's some very stringent rules apparently regarding the movies you make in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, editorial control is really tight right now. It reminds me of all the Marvel comics in the 1980s. In the 70s, Marvel comics were a complete and total mess, and the company was nearly insolvent as a result. And Jim Shooter, an editor-in-chief who is considered both and the angel and the devil that kind of saved Marvel, instituted this rigid control over writers and artists. He just did not trust them farther than he could throw them. And apparently there was at one point actually a rule, because he was going to make sure you didn't screw this up, that the main character at some point in the first X number of pages had to say, "I need to blank, but I must blank."
Just as a way for him to make sure you are following the formula properly?
Exactly. Then he knew that you had a story that had established some sort of dramatic tension, and he could rest easy on that notice. And I feel like in the same way that Netflix has determined that these 13-episode formats are where it's at, and by God, you will do them.
Yeah, I do get that opinion that there was this Marvel Netflix deal, and it was a deal for we're going to do X number of shows, and they're all going to have 13-episode seasons, and possibly some other rules about how they're going to run. And I don't know if it's lack of creativity from the writers or if the structure is just completely wrong, but the writers have been coming up with stories that don't fit 13 episodes. And if they needed 26 episodes to tell the story and they were cramming, that would be one thing. But they keep coming up with stories that are too short, and I feel that you got to put that on the writers a little bit.
Yeah, at some point, I think it always comes down to the writers, and I can speak from experience here. It's a little bit, it's sad, but as a writer, you always take some of the blame, because there's very rarely any sort of writing gig in which you are not in some ways co-writing with your producers or your, campaign manager or your editor or what have you. And that's just the name of the game. And regardless of what you put out, you know, you do your best.
Yeah, if sitting up here in the peanut gallery, it seems like that's just part of the job. That it's not my fault the story sucked. You should have seen what the producer was telling me to do. Well, at a certain point, your job is to take what the producer tells you and still turn out a good story anyway. And that's the mark of, I guess, being a great writer as opposed to a good writer. And I think the people we have on the Marvel Netflix stuff are good writers, but not great writers.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right. Well, Joe, another enjoyable discussion. And
I think we've about punished this topic enough.
You were saving that one, weren't you?
I've been sitting on that one for a while.
All right, I'm going to bed. Good night, Joe.
Good night, Adam.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to The Golden Age and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to The Golden Age, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following @FromVoxDuo on Twitter. Joe blogs at minorthoughts.com and is on Twitter @JMartinDF. Adam is on Twitter as well, @AdamVolle. That's Adam, V-O-L-L-E.